Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
The captain. We were unable to retrieve him, sir. The captain has been altered by the Borg.
Altered?
He is a Borg.
We'll go back. I need more people. We need to retune the phasers again. We'll get him out of there.
Commander, reading subspace field fluctuations from within the Borg ship. Looks like they're regenerating, restoring power. They could be capable of warp any minute.
Is the deflector ready?
It's ready.
Will, he's alive. If we could get him back to the ship, I might be able to restore...
This is our only chance to destroy them. If they get back into warp, our weapon is useless.
We'll sabotage them again if we have to.
We can't maintain power. We don't have the time. Prepare to fire.
At least consult with Starfleet Command. Get Admiral Hansen on subspace.
Belay that order, Lieutenant. There's no time.
Sir, we are being hailed by the Borg.
On screen.
Resistance is futile. Your life, as it has been, is over. From this time forward, you will service us.
Mr. Worf. Fire.
Thank you. Well, so some of the music there from Best of Both Worlds Part 2, but did it live up to the scene setting? Certainly, the original filmmakers were a little bit at odds with that. Michael Piller felt it didn't quite manage to match the opening Best of Both Worlds Part 1. We're going to find out now with, of course, the team, a couple of whom have already assembled without being assimilated in the airwaves. Let's turn to Ian Barnsley first. Ian, is this one that, having absorbed Captain Picard and his knowledge, the Borg heading for Earth, leaving Riker and the Enterprise desperate for an unanticipated way to defeat them, was it something that you easily processed?
Processing? Yes, it would do really well to live up to the first one. The first episode was particularly good, in my opinion. Doesn't quite match up to it. It is a vaguely satisfying conclusion, I think, to the first one. But I did enjoy it. I obviously watched it the first time around many, many years ago, but I did enjoy it. It was nice to revisit it.
Yeah, over 30 years ago since it first was screened, I think, on BBC television, or before that, I think it was on Sky, because if memory serves, actually, this incarnation of Star Trek was effectively screened on the BBC after it had been first screened on Sky, because they'd, or rather Rupert Murdoch had decided that it was for him, really, which, again, I think irritated me at the time, because obviously one didn't have a satellite dish. However, somebody who has always got a satellite dish to hand is Larry Namicek, of course, the author and creator of the Ultimate Guide to the Star Trek Next Generation series, still available, although it needs probably another update, probably in the not-too-distant future with Picard. I mean, are you working on that, Larry?
From your lips to the great bird's ears, Alex, that would be wonderful.
Well, we'll go with that, because it's certainly...
No plan is yet, but there we go.
If you incorporate Nemesis, given the connection that Nemesis had with all three seasons of Picard, I think it's only right that should also be encompassed within the whole basis. But that's another topic, another demonstration. We're just finding out, Ian, and like myself, kind of felt this wasn't quite something which quite lived up to expectations, pretty much as you said that Michael Piller felt about the thing when he went back to write it, and with only, I think, 2 weeks to shooting, came up with the integration line as a possible solution. Let's check out with Jared Palmer, though. Jared, your thoughts on this one, as somebody who, again, has seen this several times now.
I think I really did like the episode. I don't think it's as good as its first one with the cliffhanger, but I did enjoy the episode, and I did really like the idea of Riker having to take on full responsibility of the Enterprise and having to struggle between getting out of the commander's chair and into the captain's chair. And I really did like the idea of him having to battle an enemy who he's known for years, who he's respected as a father figure. And I kind of really did like the overall impact of this episode, because later on in the episodes, of course, John Luke becomes a little bit more haunted by his actions. And of course, later on into the films and First Contact, you see a lot more of the parallels that they draw between the experience he has here and the experience he has in First Contact as well.
You do like to draw on the upcoming treats and spoilers there with respect to First Contact, of course. Larry, I mean, lots of nice things about this episode. I mean, in many ways, the women, as you alluded to in your description, really save the day here, whilst all the rest of the shenanigans and Cavalier-type activities are going on, and Borg and Data are obviously rescuing Picard, or at least kidnapping the Borg, Locutus, and then subsequently rescuing Picard. The women actually get on with it and solve the day, really.
That's true. There's that one line where she says, where Crusher says, he's exhausted. It's a little bit of a throw, but most of the time, yeah, the women are, they're not, you know, running and jumping and phaser firing, which is what Gates had wanted. And she got a little of that in the first part. But no, it was a good team approach. And I got to agree that everybody, I don't know what could have lived up to the hype of Best of Both Worlds Summer, you know, Locutus Summer. I mean, they do it, and it makes sense. It's the trouble is, every time they've defeated the Borg since, it's been some variation of you use their Achilles heel against them, and that's always been the key, even down to the, you know, the Borg the fleet maneuver that they do at the end of Picard season 3. So spoilers, but it's almost like, how would you fulfill that? And just the idea that Piller had said, Michael Piller had given himself that, you know, that no win scenario to defeat about how we're going to get out of this. And then when you watch the show, you go, well, duh, of course, that's what they would do. The weakest part of the whole thing for me was we used to laugh. I remember the first time we watched this, and as the cube is getting closer to Earth and getting closer to the solar system and within the solar system, those three little kind of submarine looking ships go out to attack the cube, and it just goes bing, 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 and picks them off. And somebody reports and says, well, the Mars perimeter alert system has been destroyed. And you're like, really? That was your defense of Earth, was three little ships? So, you know, we kind of laughed about that. But anyway, they were having to accomplish a lot. But the get back Picard, the rescue Picard, rescue Locutus kind of maneuver, when you're starting to think Riker is not going to have it with him, or he's going to succumb to his Shelby envy or whatever. Then it's like, aha, Riker's, and his talk with Guinan, which was, you know, inspiring. It's like, okay, he's got this after all along. And again, I'll say this is the two-parter to me that, aside from the Picard legacy plot that gets, returned to over and over again and launches DS9 and all of that, the thing about this two-parter is what it did for Riker's character. And I felt like we and they finally got a handle on Riker going forward.
The Guinan-Riker interplay, for me, I'll always reveal, will be my favorite scene from this particular episode. Because I felt that, I mean, from the initial line where you could see that Riker was too busy, he couldn't cope, but then he kind of just took a moment and realized, actually, maybe this was something that, rather than relying on Picard, he would rely on a relationship, which very much opened that. And, of course, the line that Guinan comes up with about needing to let Picard go, of course, something which very much kind of emerged in the 1980s in terms of psychotherapy, etc. If you love someone, let them go. There can only be one captain. And I felt that actually did work for me in terms of the way that the narrative was expanded, etc. Of course, Whoopi Goldberg would go on to be a semi-recurring regular, really, in terms of this and subsequent series. So a nice point there from, obviously, the bartender, or El Orion, as we let her discover. Ian, favourite moments for yourself?
I mean, yeah, the Guinan talk to Riker was pretty good. I mean, I kind of, you know, talking about what's coming on in future series and in the First Contact film, we don't know yet quite why she hates the Borg as she does. And she has, she has more reason to hate them than the most. Yet she still was able to direct Riker in the room there, and she had the audacity to sit in the captain's chair in the ready room, which doesn't look very comfortable to me, to be honest. It looks like it might fall over.
Yeah, the ergonomic design probably leaving a little bit to be desired there in terms of systems. Although, having said that, Ian, it's not too dissimilar to the kind of chairs we use as staff at the University of Lincoln these days. So it has an unfortunate tendency to occasionally sort of just sink in various ways. But who knows? Maybe that's just another line, or maybe it's just wish fulfillment on my part. Jared, what about your favourite moments?
I would say I have two favourite moments in this one. I would say my favourite moment for this was the bit where Riker sort of stands tall on his own on the bridge of the Enterprise, in the battle bridge. And he's like already accepting that he has to do something that would go against sort of like what Picard would have to do, but he has to do it because there's no other option to do it. And sort of the way that he sort of like is able to like stand tall and like sort of like look upon like recruiters and say that, you know me through Picard
implicitly trusted me.
Yeah, exactly. And because of that, I really did like that moment where Will's character finally is able to step out into the shadows of the command chair and into the captain's chair. And I would say the next favorite moment, I would say, is the closing bit where Picard looks on Earth. And I think it's in the way that he's still starting to deal with his trauma. As he said to Troy, he remembers everything that happened. And of course, the episode after deals with some of that. And of course, the rest of the series does. But I think it was that episode particularly that he just looks outside the window and he looks at what could have happened if he wasn't stopped. So I think it's a feeling of relief, but also a feeling of guilt. And it definitely does come back to haunt Picard and throughout the rest of Next Gen, and I think even to Picard as well.
I was guilty of misremembering that final sequence, actually, because I always felt that his hands trembled with the cup of tea. Actually, it doesn't. But for some reason, I think because of the slight tinkle that you actually got there, I thought that was a really subtle piece of acting that Stewart had put into place, Patrick Stewart. But actually, he didn't. It was a very measured put down of the cup of tea, basically. And funny enough, I mean, again, I'm clearly a handover director, all chores to Mr. Bowl. He did an excellent job on this side of things there. But I might have been tempted to maybe just had a slight tremble of the hands there to kind of emphasize that actually his control wasn't as perfect as it was when he said, "Make it so, number one. You know, go ahead. It's all over. It's all back to normal, really. The reset button has been set." Larry, your thoughts on that, and indeed your own favorite moments?
I was going to say at the time, whether I'm with you when you talk about the episode family or not, it's something to say that no one considered that episode. Ron Moore and some of the staff and Michael wanted to do a part three to this two-parter because they wanted to get away from episodic television. Okay, well, that's done. Let's move on. You know, I said, no, this has been too traumatic to just, you know, done and dusted and move on. And so it's a testament to their persuasiveness that they kind of went against the TV norms to do that. But that said, even the little bit we get when Riker gets back in the ready room and it's like, oh, okay, things are back to normal. Well, not quite. Here's Picard with these therapeutic, you know, scalp bandages, basically healing, and where his implants have been removed. It's kind of a slap in the face to remind you that it's not all over and done, and there's still a healing process. There's a retransition, you know, and trauma as well as physical, you know, physiology. But I think one of the moments is in the Guinan scene where she immediately, where you start off and she's like, oh, okay, now Guinan's going to cancel Riker the way she cancels Picard. Okay. But the way she takes the high ground and takes his chair, and it immediately throws everything into a kimbo there where it's like, well, wait a minute, that's not her chair. Well, wait a minute, Riker wasn't really claiming it. You know, it's like she kind of smacks the ball rolling here. She kind of upends the inertia and kind of makes him, well, if you want that chair, you're going to have to take it. It was just this nice little, you know, kind of claiming moment, but she was really pushing him into doing what he needed to do. But that and just I loved in their little budget, and it's not a big deal, but I loved again how with their limited budget and resources, and they still didn't even have a big working shuttlecraft, you know, set. They kind of cudgel it together, but just the whole rescue of, it's just a little thing. But Worf and Data in on the, we don't know what's happening. We didn't even know they had portable transporters like that. And just the kind of the black ops rescue mission of Picard, when Starfleet would have said, forget him, let's worry about the Borg. And they're thinking, no, he's the key to understanding the Borg. We've got to get this back. So those two little moments. And then the way that the token little wrap up scene at the end is kind of, and it ends with him staring off into space. And I remember thinking, you know, just seconds later on the first view, before we knew what was happening, for a moment there, you're kind of left wondering, wow, what does this mean for the future? And if you'd had 10 seconds to think about it, you would say, gosh, surely they're not just going to move on from this like everything is hunky-dory for the next episode. And what's our next planet to go to and solve? But then they immediately would have run the trailer for the next week's episode, you know, next week on Star Trek, the Next Generation. And you would have seen him back in France and you're like, whoa, they're on Earth and he's with his family. And I forget exactly what the narrative was, but you would have got the idea that they were going to sit with this a moment and let his trauma play out in some way. And a little piece of you might have thought, oh, this is, you know, A, it's going to be cool because they're back on Earth, which they never did. In fact, I think it was the first time and that any Star Trek had done that, aside from the movie showing San Francisco. But
and time travel, you know, of course.
It's just, yes, yes. Well, yeah, right. But I mean, in the moment, in the linear moment. So as part of me wants to say, you know, we would have all been saying, no, don't move on. You would have had that undercut immediately because you would have seen the trailer. If your mind was going that way, you would have immediately seen and been, you know, re-intrigued all over again about what was to come.
As one didn't actually see trailers, and in fact, I'm just recalling that it wasn't even on the BBC where I first saw this. I probably actually purchased the VHS tape that it was actually sort of issued on from that point of view. So I think, again, it would have come across as a, one of the two-parters there. So it was actually an interesting experience. And we'll talk about family, obviously, in the next episode of Resonance Rewind. Nice to see that Shelby was actually still acting up. And I think mm-hmm. it's extraordinary that she wasn't, because I think it's a good performance by Elizabeth Dennehy. In fact, a very good performance by Elizabeth Dennehy. And such a shame, because I think she would have been such an ideal foil to replace Wesley Crusher, who, again, has that look of extreme terror on his face when Riker says collision course. And that you can tell that basically, you know, that is where basically probably the F-bomb would have been dropped if it was revealed in a contemporary version of Star Trek from right. Wesley Crusher when that order was given.
Yes, young Wesley grew up quickly in that hour. Because he was about to say that, you know, of course, it's all about timing. And he was about to say that, you know, ramming speed or whatever, collision course.
It just goes to show you might be a child prodigy, but if you put in charge of the whole thing, you might actually have to ram a Borg cube. But let's go back to Dennehy, because, I mean, was there any serious talk about her getting a regular role on the series? Or was it just a case of, no, we'll just let fandom take over that and give her a role on a completely different sort of narrative and never really bring her back until Picard?
Yeah, no, not really. The closest thing to a shakeup was some kind of buzz about whether Patrick would come back. But really, the only question, as we said last week, I think, was whether Michael Piller would come back. And that was his own decision, whether he wanted to commit. He had a year in, whether he wanted, and it had been a horrible, rough, hard year where he came in late. He was kind of riding the rails, as it were. He had good friends like Ira on staff, but it was such a rough situation. Everybody basically cleared the decks and he was left with young Ron Moore, baby writer Ron, and kind of rebuilt the staff from that. But he decided to stay. And the cast was not so much even the behind the scenes people, the third season on, pretty much Marvin Rush, the DP, Bob Blackman is in costume design. The team that kind of came to third season pretty much stayed in place for the rest of the run of TNG and the rest of the Berman shows. So it was really, I think, more of it was great casting. And if you look, I was just checking this. If you look at Elizabeth Dennehy's IMDb, the highlight credit of all her years acting was playing Shelby in Next Gen on this two-parter. But I think that was never planned. I didn't think they weren't going to shake up the cast one more time. But it was great for buzz. The whole summer was great for, is Picard going away? I mean, they really used that to promote the shows and you know, create doubt in people's minds. And people wondered, who is Shelby going to be the new first officer? You know, is Riker going to be captain now and she's going to be the first officer and you'll have that spark? I don't think it was ever the intention, but they milked it for all it was worth.
And of course, Gene Roddenberry himself, sadly, only another 2 years on the planet, or really less than 2 years, by this stage, presumably taking much more of a back seat in terms mm-hmm. of the role. I'm not sure. It's difficult to know, and it'd be interesting if anybody could actually find out whether he would have approved of a new big bad, as opposed to the Romulans and Klingons and so on, which very much this was the case with the Borg.
Well, he enjoyed, because they'd been created second season when Maury Hurley was the showrunner and he was more involved. He was so much enamored by them. And I think that was a concept he'd wanted to get into. On the Trek Files, on my podcast, Sir Roddenberry, we talk about mind. He was talking about a hive mind mentality, and you see little doses of it occasionally, you know, even in the other Treks. But he was, in fact, he went out on a limb and they kidded around in the office, and somehow it got translated into Gene's theory that the Borg were the people who repaired Voyager 6 and turned it into V'ger and gave it that quest, which doesn't really sit well. But that was like a fun fan theory for a while, but it started with, you know, he and the writers and some of the staff kind of kicking around the idea, because the Borg became such a big deal and V'ger was still this enigma, and they were like, oh, why don't we
we're going slightly off topic here, maybe actually the Borg were indeed the offspring of Ilea and Will Decker, that effectively that new form of creation that was actually there, maybe that set the sequence which led to the Borg.
Could have, until you got further into Voyager and you found out that the Borg had been around at least for a few hundred years. So
time warps can happen. I'm just saying.
Okay. You Strange New World apologist there. Okay, just keep mucking with that timeline now with the temporal Cold War.
Jared, favorite characters?
I would have to say Locutus and Riker for this one. I think for me, I often view Patrick Stewart as tend to be the hero character. So I've not really watched him many times as a villain. But when he is for this instance, I just really enjoyed him as a villain. And it's clear from my mind that Locutus became a fan favorite, because I think in like one of the video games, Star Trek Armada, they bring him back as like a Dominion Borg clone. So it's clear to me that the idea of Locutus was really loved by the fans. And I think he's very intimidating as a villain, despite the fact that Picard himself is trying to fight back against him, as you see that tear sort of drips in his eyes as he's being fully upgraded. And I also sort of like the dynamic he had with Riker as well. And I think for me, if it had been a three part, I think we would have seen a little bit more of it, but I like what we got from it. So I'll leave it at that.
You raise a very interesting point there. Say the very neat close-up shot of the single tear falling from Picard, which I think, again, it epitomized and, of course, foreshadows, and again, mini spoiler here, what we will then go on to see in Family, where we get more than a single tear, but we certainly get a huge reveal in terms of how this physical assault, mental assault, very much invasion, really almost destroyed the character Jean-Luc Picard, this man who, as we found out, or we heard from George Murdoch's Admiral Hanson, was a cadet who basically beat so many people, and he proved so much, and he made it his decision to actually get to know him and so on. I don't think actual Admiral Hanson ever emerges again, really. We're not sure whether he actually survived the Battle of Wolf 359 or did he? I mean, was that just left up to the imagination? Because the last time we saw him, of course, was on a very wonky screen in which he was basically saying, "The fight does not go well, Enterprise." Ian, your favourite characters?
Guinan is my favourite character in it, really. But it's a toss-up between Guinan and Riker. I did think Riker's smug look on his face when his plan worked was quite interesting. And I would also say that Picard's tear also just kind of suggests that he was in there. Part of him was still in there, even though he was Locutus and the Borg probes had got, you know, taken over his mind. He was still there. He was able to shed a tear when he was doing things he didn't really want to be able to be doing. But I think Guinan.
It certainly still has a contemporary resonance. I mean, Ian and myself currently sort of spending an awful lot of time dealing with artificial intelligence and ways in which that's being developed and put together. In fact, we're working on a title for our research group, which I think currently stands as, is it Digital Clusters, Ian? That's one of the things that's actually there. So, Larry, if you've got some creativity and come up with a better title than Digital Clusters, please, you know, we would welcome that input. You know, we certainly put it into the mix. But yeah, in terms of that, does it actually also echo in terms of our fears that we have about technology these days, that actually we can be assimilated, you know, we can be taken over, and yet the argument from the Borg, as expressed by Locutus, is that each species will improve immeasurably as a result of their assimilation, which, of course, Worf responds by saying, "I like my species as it is." Ironic, given, of course, the Klingon genetic changes that have obviously taken place over the years. I mean, any thoughts on that one, Larry, in terms of the way it kind of still evidence as something which is a classic trope of science fiction, the fear of the artificial life form, the artificial intelligence?
Well, right. Well, that's the whole spine of the Borg to begin with, is that they can't be, you can reason with, you can outwit, you can play games with a Klingon or a Romulan or a Cardassian, but the Borg were supposed to be the faceless, you know, oncoming drone army that couldn't be reasoned with. And there's been a little debate, and as much as Jared loved Locutus's character, stepping back, there were a lot of people who said the minute you went to a Locutus, and the minute then later on you went to a Borg queen, just as a dramatist trying to get a handle on having the Borg, you know, Q-Who, it was just that wall of, you know, the coral, the Borg monks or whatever, you know, chanting at you all their tropes and things, their standard lines. And that was one thing. And they were scary at the beginning. Then you saw the drones show up as sentries, as, you know, the hands of the collective, the arms of the collective. But while it was great dramatically as a Picard device and for us to care about Picard and be terrified and what's going to, you know, and then, oh my God, everything Picard knows, they're going to turn back on us like a feedback loop. But as you went from the series, the trouble with the Borg being such uber great villains was that they weren't villains per se. They were adversaries, but the bar was raised. They created them and didn't know what to do with them because they were such a fan favorite instantly. And then after Best of Both Worlds, people all, oh, let's have another Borg story. But the problem for the writers was, okay, what do we do with them? And how do we then over, you know, we have to overcome it in the end. And how do we not get into some kind of a revolving door with, oh, you know, and we beat them this way this time. How do we beat them the next time without being repetitive? Oh, just do a single command, ha ha, trick them and feed, you know, turn their hive mind against themselves, their collective conscience. So the very next Borg show you have is Hugh, I think, I Borg. So they went small with it. And then you mix them up with Lore, you know, and they were renegade Borg who had been cut off from the collective. So it's, the Borg by their nature are interesting, but it was a be careful what you wish for, you may get it kind of success. Mm-hmm. You know, they were the great ultimate foe that nobody knew what to do. And that's why eventually it just turned into, we have to do them with First Contact, and they upgraded and they used a movie budget to do that. And there are people that would say during the run of Voyager that the constant running into the Borg and all that. I mean, you've got, when you have Seven of Nine in the cast, and I don't mean to get off on Voyager here, but once you had Annika Hansen as a Borg in the Voyager cast, you had to revisit Borg bits, and you were in the Delta Quadrant and that was their home. So it was going to be inevitable, but structurally the Borg for Star Trek's universe and storytelling, there are some people who would say that using the Borg so often in Voyager kind of lessened their, you know, lessened their danger, their thrill, their ominous, their meanness, their evilness, you know, their threat. The big bad threat wasn't quite so big bad as it was back here during Best of Both Worlds days. Anyway,
again, it's interesting because clearly, you know, with respect to Doctor Who, the Daleks and the Cybermen, regularly occurring nemesis, which obviously people mm-hmm. have different sort of views on and different takes on that as well. And I see an interesting debate between Jared and Barnes and Ian in terms of, is it, 359 or 359? But Jared, you've managed to locate the fact that the Admiral is indeed listed as dead, basically. He is no longer with us. Oh, well, that's sad. Never mind, at least in the world of Star Trek. Okay, we are coming around to the scores. We still might be hearing from Jessica Burtis, and she'll be giving us her take on the whole sequence. But Jared, what is your score out of 10 for Best of Both Worlds Part 2?
I would say I would put this one at a 9.4. I would say it's a really good sequel, but I think for me, the problem was that I think it needed a bit more time to develop, and I think that's where the Part 3 might have come in for it personally. But I still think it was a solid episode. I did like the dynamics that were at play, and I thought the cinematography was amazing for its time, and especially when you go back into the Borg cube and you come out. And also the idea of having to put Picard into this like circular device as like Data tries to like connect with him. And yeah, ultimately, I think it was a really solid episode, personally.
And arguably, I think, as we'll make a point in the next edition, I think Family is actually a three-parter. I mean, to me, the three work together, and that's where it does open up a whole range of things. Ian, what about yourself?
I gave Part 1 a 9, and this is the first time I've actually watched Part 2 just on its own in preparation for this. I usually watch the whole thing in one go, and the whole thing I would give 9. I think just Part 2 I would give 7. I think it just on its own, it's a little bit of a letdown in my opinion. But, you know, it does round off the story reasonably well.
I'm probably going an 8.5. It would have got a 9 had they actually had a general tremble of the hand with that T scenario there. I'm just saying, for Cliff Bowles' sort of future routine, a little hand trembling thing can actually be very effective. Larry, of course, you gave a 10 to Part 1 last week. I suspect you're not going to match that for Part 2, or maybe you are.
No, and I And I watched this again too. I went on my memory for part one, but for part two, I wanted to see how much of a, I don't say a letdown, because they do survive. And it's not so much eventually the answer they stumble across, but I think watching the team play, and again, getting back to the two regular female characters having a major part in sussing it out. And they're basically cutting back and forth between Data's lab, you know, and the bridge during the final climax. So, and watching all the, you know, when they're, whether they're separated or they're back together, watching everybody in red be studly, you know, command figures. And meanwhile, the nerve center of the crisis solving is Data, Locutus, and then Troy and Crusher. So it, and it struck me too, people that think about this as a letdown, I mean, it almost has to be a letdown because you were so stoked with the setup for part one. And in that case, it's you're solving the problem. You're not getting to set up the cool. I mean, I think the best action piece, as I said, was the Operation Rescue Picard. Mm. And everything else is just everybody, you know, Guinan poking Riker. And then once you have the plan in place, we watch it unroll. And then it turns into you're in set piece. Basically, you're in set pieces. You're when they all get back together, now you're watching the bridge work. You're watching the lab work. And having its breakthrough. So if it just turns into those two pieces as you solve the problem and we get to the climax, then maybe that's why it feels a little let down. And in hindsight, maybe that there's nothing you could have done about that. But unless you had some kind of like last minute heroics, like Kirk beaming off the Constellation, the Doomsday Machine back in the original series. But I'm not, it has to be lower. So I'm going to say, because some things could have been punched up a little more, I'm going to say an 8.
Yeah, I think that's a valid overview.
That's
whole
my
thing.
Long wandering way to get to that, but justifying that. But
long and wandering.
I felt kinder toward it watching this time than I did just relying on memory.
And that's what Resonance Rewind is all about, Larry. Hopefully, you're able to join us for family because you are part of the Resonance Rewind family, and for that matter, the Midweek Drive Live family. So it's always good from that point of view. Ian, I think you're back with us for family, and likewise, hopefully, Jared as well. We'll hopefully get some additional sort of input from that perspective. Finally, Larry, just a plug for how people can actually follow yourself and indeed your own podcasts and magical delights with respect to Star Trek.
Yes, Larry Nemechek on Twitter X, but LarryNemechek.com on my website. And it's the Trek Files comes out every Tuesday from Roddenberry Podcasts. And I have a live stream Tuesdays live in the afternoons here, which is evening for you all. And Portal 47, my backstage company, and our Trekland Treks tours that we do. And everything on my YouTube channel. I never plug my YouTube channel because I get into it so late. So everybody, please like and subscribe.
We shall certainly do that. Jared Palmer, Ian Barnsley, and Larry Nemechek, huge thanks. We might just hear from Jessica Bertas before this program concludes. If not, we'll have some more music from Best of Both Worlds Part 2. Well, the great news is we can actually now turn to the sole female member for this particular aspect of Resonance Rewind. Bizarrely, I know Pamela Sue Mann is otherwise engaged, and likewise, I think Victoria Simmons is also planning for a concert. So we turn to Jessica Bertas. Jessica, of course, you've seen Best of Both Worlds as a feature-length film, and now you've seen it in two parts. We're focusing on Best of Both Worlds Part 2. Share with us your thoughts. You've heard what the team have said. What are your own?
Part two, I actually think that some others had some thought the first part was a lot stronger than the second part, but I think that if they're watched together, especially like you're saying, like as if it is a movie, I think that they work together extremely well. I do think that the second part is a little bit not slower, but it does have a little bit less going on than the first part. But I think, like Larry said, that makes sense because the first part was setting up the whole conflict. So you had a lot of introductions to people and a lot of questioning, like what was going to happen at the midpoint. But I think that this was resolution. It was an all's well kind of ending. And I mean, were the Borg like completely destroyed? Like, was their species completely destroyed? I was gonna say that would be like kind of depressing, but I think it's fine. It worked out for everybody, not the Borg, but you know, it worked out for everybody else, and it was good to see Picard again. But I like that they also didn't just skim past the fact that he had been assimilated. They kind of had him looking down at Earth, you know, thinking. And I think that was good to end on, because even though it had a happy ending for everyone, I like that they didn't just brush past the whole assimilation part, and that they did keep that moment of him just contemplating. I think that that was a very good ending.
Yes, no, the Borg certainly do emerge with a vengeance in all sorts of
Good.
ways with Borg queens and so on. So they're still out there attempting to assimilate all manner of species and so on. Favorite moments, Jessica, which were your favorite moments in this particular text?
I think I really liked seeing Riker really try to emerge. I think his conversation with, I forget her name.
Guinan.
Thank you. Yes. I think that their conversation, Guinan's perspective and her presence was so interesting in this episode. And I think that seeing Riker really have to come to grips with, he's not like Picard, but that's okay. He's his own person and he has his own way of running this, I think was really nice to see, because we've seen so many different leaders in this show. You know, I think Picard is very different from Captain Kirk, and Riker is very different from Picard and Kirk. So I like seeing that he's not trying to be like Picard anymore. There was character growth quite a lot for him in this show, even though it was two parts. I loved seeing that. And also just getting to see Shelby also getting more of a role, and them working together was nice after all of the tension from part one. I thought that that was really great. And of course, like I said, then Picard staring down at Earth at the closing.
Yes, of course, the line that when he promotes Shelby to be first officer, effectively he says reluctantly, and clearly he has to explain to both Worf and Data why he didn't actually appoint either of them, because you can imagine certainly in an environment that conceivably they might have thought that they would have been next in line. Obviously, Data arguably would be an android and wouldn't actually feel that emotion side of things. Worf, of course, being Klingon, might have been slightly more tense. But again, I thought that was a well adjusted way of actually ensuring that, okay, within the considerations, they were actually better rather than looking to do another job, to actually do the jobs that they were doing and to keep them in that particular place.
Yes, I think so. And I think having that acknowledgement was nice. I think even though it was a whole long part, but I also think it's kind of funny because it did keep up a little bit of like the type of rivalry almost that they have. You know, he's not just like bestowing it as a gift on Shelby because Riker absolutely adores Shelby and they're best friends. It's like Shelby is the best for this job right now. And I think that that gave a lot more credence to her, because I think it wasn't like patronizing in that way, in that, oh, well, he'll just give it to her. It's like, no, she deserves this. She's earned it. And I think that this whole trial by fire was a cool way to see Shelby really come out as a character that's very interesting.
Larry rightly pointed out to the fact that this was an episode in which actually it was the women who effectively solved the problem by effectively finding out what Picard meant when he said sleep and all the other elements. Did you feel that actually the genders were well represented with Diana Troi, of course, as the counselor, with Shelby, as we've already spoken about, with Dr. Crusher, and of course, Guinan?
I did. I thought that the women in this episode were really excellent. I think that they played very active roles. I think that they weren't just there for the development of the male characters and their stories. I think that they each supported each other quite a lot. And I think that the women had very distinct personalities. And even though they all have one end goal, you know, to save the Enterprise, well, to save Earth, but to kind of keep the Enterprise going and save Earth from the Borg, I think that they still all had unique goals within that situation. So it made it, you wouldn't be able to just conflate them all together. So I think that that's nice. They're all very individual. And I do like that they made them so distinct with their personalities. I like that a lot. So, and I mean, Star Trek does a very good job of that. So, and it was nice to see in such an intense episode with so much on the line and so many of the male characters having a lot of important positions, to see that the women were still, you know, active participants and making a massive difference. And like you said, really turning the tides of the whole conflict.
It's interesting, of course, that because of the scale of the threat, the challenge that was faced with, I think one of the interesting lines was in 3 weeks, all that might be left of the Federation would be nanites. So clearly they were faced with not just a clear and present danger, but a danger that technically could have actually wiped out the Federation and, of course, planet Earth and Sector 001 completely. Let's talk a bit about the music, because we've sort of mentioned Ron Jones's line. Obviously, Jerry Goldsmith's theme, of course, is there. But how did you feel it worked? Did you feel it had the right level of threat, the right level of dynamism to actually accompany this particular side of things? I mean, we've used the term cinematic before. Do you feel as though that also worked within the musical underpinning of this particular show?
I did like it, actually. I think I didn't notice the music quite so much in part one, but with this one, we had a bit more of those like battle scenes. And I think that music suits it very well. And I think that you know, the music can really change the emotions of the scene, and they have such a massive role within movies, even though we often, I'd say sometimes, like if you're just watching a movie kind of or a show, we don't tend to notice the music always like right off the bat, but it's there to strengthen what's happening and really make you feel what's going on. And I do think that this was a good instance of it. I think Star Trek, I mean, the intro and everything, they have a good foundation to build on of music in Star Trek. So I liked it. Yeah, part one did not so much stand out to me, but this one was better.
And your favorite character, Jessica, where are you going to go? I mean, we haven't mentioned, of course, Chief Miles O'Brien, played by Colm Meaney. We've obviously spoken about Wesley Crusher, played by Will Wheaton, of course, Commander Data. But where do you want to actually go in terms of your favorite character, and indeed any honorable mentions for this particular episode?
I would say honorable mention, Guinan. I thought that she was super interesting, and I really liked how much clarity she had within everything that was going on, and kind of just had to give Riker a slap, to a metaphorical slap, to kind of bring him to his senses. But I think Data was my favorite in this. Data had a very active role here, and I do think it's funny that every time people are like, we have to save like just Picard, and Data's like, I need to know about the Borg. And I just liked how Data had a very clear goal, and it was very funny to me. And that moment of like realizing that Picard is still in there, and I thought that Data was very brave in this. And I mean, conversations around AI and TV shows are always super interesting. So I think Data stood out to me. I hadn't expected that. So I think that's Data wins for me for this episode.
Played by Brent Spiner. Okay, now's the time then, Jessica. You've heard what Larry and Jared and Ian and myself actually gave this particular episode. Where are you going to go for Best of Both Worlds Part 2?
I'd say if we're just looking at part two, if I were to watch it on its own, I'd have to agree with your score of 8.5. I think that that's a good score for part two. If I'm watching like the whole thing together, I'd probably give it a 9.5. I do recommend that if anybody is like watching them, try and watch it all. Just treat it like a movie. Sit down with some popcorn, watch the whole thing.
Well, next week, of course, you said, what about the aftermath? We continue our exploration of the Star Trek and Next Generation universe, because we actually see what happens when Picard does try to cope with the trauma of the Borg possession. We also see Worf's adopted parents. We also see a variety of other things in an episode which, of course, followed on directly from Best of Both Worlds Part 2 in Season 4, Episode 2, and it's called Family. Until then, keep on resonating.
Thank you.